Welcome back to the Border Patrol on Sports Radio 810 WHB. Let's talk some baseball with Buster Olney from ESPN. Buster, good morning. How are you?
I'm doing great. What's going on?
Well, the Braves don't lose, I can tell you that. And they unfortunately lost one of their best players to a broken foot, and he's going to be out for a while. But that does not stop them. They look incredible right now. What do you think of these streaking Braves? 14 in a row now?
Yeah, 14 in a row, and I know this because my son is a huge Braves fan, and every night he texts me the number. And just at the outset of that streak, just as it was beginning, I did a radio show in Alabama, and I declared that the National League East was over, that the Braves had no chance to catch the Mets, that they were 11 and a half games out at that point. Of course, it was over.
Right.
And for the Braves, they would still continue, because I picked the Braves to go to the World Series this year, and I said, look, I still feel good about that pick. They can reach the postseason as they did last year and then put stuff together, but forget it, they can't catch the Mets. And, of course, I'm getting a lot of tweets about that one. That is probably the dumbest of many dumb picks that I'm going to wind up making this year. They look phenomenal. I think the biggest, two big developments for them, in my eyes, one, Kyle Wright, and I'm biased because he's a Vanderbilt guy, really building off that World Series appearances that he had last year and developing into one of the best starters in the National League. He, I'm assuming is going to be on the All-Star team this year because he's just been that good. And two, the surge has coincided with the promotion of Michael Harris, the second, tremendous young center fielder. I love the fact that Alex Anthopoulos, their general manager, really began to focus on defense as he looked at what his team needed. Last year, before the trade deadline, he focused on offense and added guys like, Jock Peterson, Eddie Rosario. This year, looking at his outfield, Adam Duvall was playing center field. They call Michael Harris, who's one of their best prospects. He's an elite defensive center fielder. He's also been hitting. And you put him alongside Ronald Acuna Jr. and you put Adam Duvall on the other side, that is a tremendous outfield which supports really good pitching. It is a dangerous team.
And this may shock a baseball fan like Nathan Bucati across from me. But correct me if I'm wrong, Buster, but Michael Harris had 43 games played at Double-A, 174 bats at Double-A, and that's it. Never sniffed Triple-A and went right to the majors, right?
That's exactly right. He had six games in Triple-A last year. You're right. He had only 43 games. And I remember texting Alex right when they made the promotion. I was like, so what's your thinking? And he goes, well, he said, we know that, the defense can play. We'll see how the bat does. But, what you don't really know until the player gets in the big leagues is what kind of presence do they have. Alec Manoah, to me, of the Blue Jays, is a best example of someone competing as if they belong in the big leagues. From the first day that Manoah reached the majors, it's like, I'm here and I'm going to have fun and I'm going to, compete with these guys. And that's the way Michael Harris looks when you watch him play. He just looks completely comfortable and he plays with some swag. I think we talked about this last week about how in one of his first games at big leagues, he made this amazing catch running into right center field and tracking down a deep drive. And behind home plate, Andrew Jones, of course, arguably the greatest defensive center fielder ever, former Brave, happened to be in the ballpark, and the cameras panned on Andrew when that catch was made, and you could read his lips. He goes, wow. If you can impress Andrew Jones with how much ground you're covering in center field, that tells you something. He is a guy who looks like he could be a difference maker.
And so look, I get he's the exception, not the rule, but I bring this up because in Kansas City, It's mind-numbing that Vinny Pasquantino continues to rake at AAA while the Royals have embarrassing production at first base. And J.J. Piccolo said this, but I've seen other people say this around baseball, that there's never been a bigger gap between AAA and the majors. But then you see Michael Harris, and if you're wondering how he's doing, he's got an 894 OPS. He's hitting 328 for the Braves. I don't know if that's going to continue, but he's hit the ground running. And so I just, it gets frustrating for Royals fans to hear these excuses. And like you mentioned, Alex Manoa. Well, there's a starting pitcher that has found a way to be very successful right away to get hit the ground running. And it just feels like, you know, and look, Bobby Witt Jr. is a different guy. He struggled for a while, but he's raking right now. But it is allowed for hot prospects and blue chip prospects to come up and perform right away. We're seeing that around baseball, and it is interesting to me that the Braves decided, okay, we need Harris, we need his defense, let's skip AAA, and he's been very, very good. And I wonder if that could lead other teams to maybe be a little bit more aggressive, despite what people have said about the gap between AAA and the majors.
Yeah, and I absolutely hear that. I do feel like that those, you know, decisions are different from organization to organization. You know, we talked a couple weeks ago about Grayson Rodriguez, who was held down in the minor leagues with he's one of the best pitching prospects in baseball. He was held down in the minor leagues by the Orioles because, quote unquote, he was developing, right? He had a 209 ERA, had 80 strikeouts, one home run allowed in 55 innings. He got hurt. It was a, you know, an injury now, which is going to keep him in the minor leagues probably for the rest of this year. And that was a service time manipulation. There's no doubt about it, right? With other organizations, if the Braves, for example, I think it really just comes down to when the player is comfortable, when they feel like he's ready to go. I think that's the way it is with the Blue Jays too. And so much of it comes down to how can this player handle failure? Because that's inevitable in baseball. It's a sport that's built on failure. And if you watch Manoa compete, you know that, you know, A, he's confident he's going to do well, and B, if he gets knocked around a little bit, he's going to have the confidence to make the adjustments and to, you know, to counterpunch. Michael Harris, you watch him do the same thing. I've never talked to Vinny. All I know is what I've heard about it from other people. I hear he's of the Alec Manoa, Michael Harris, you know, mindset, where he just conducts himself as if he belongs. And while he might have an adjustment period, in the way that Bobby Witt Jr. has clearly had an adjustment period, he'll be fine. Whenever they promote him, and you would assume that's going to be very soon, he'll be ready to go. And yeah, he'll be an upgrade over what they have in their lineup, because you can't get worse, right? Than some of the production that they're getting at various spots.
We're visiting with our baseball insider, Buster Olney. And Buster, when you started talking about this Braves team off the bat here, you mentioned Kyle Wright and his emergence as one of the best starting pitchers in baseball this year. And my initial reaction right when you said it was, man, it's just still crazy to me that this Royals regime came from Atlanta. You know, Dayton Moore and J.J. Piccolo, they came from Atlanta, who just seems like they've done nothing but produce starting pitching for three decades now, and yet the Royals have never really been able to develop their own starting pitching. And right now we've got this wave of guys they drafted that are struggling to produce. But I will say the story on Kyle Wright is interesting because he's 26 and it wasn't smooth. And I think he spent most of last year in AAA trying to figure things out because he really struggled in all of his appearances in the big leagues up until this point. So he's about a year older than these guys the Royals got, like Brady Singer and Daniel Lynch, et cetera. Is there anything we can learn about his arc and the way he has finally figured things out that will give us reason to be encouraged here in Kansas City about those guys?
Yeah, I think the lesson to be learned from Kyle Wright's journey through professional baseball is that not everybody is on the same timeline, and you need to have patience. And look, we have to give Alex Anthopoulos a ton of credit for what he did when he went to the Braves organization. He came from the Dodgers. He, of course, had been the, you know, general manager of the Toronto Blue Jays, but he lands with the Braves. And we've seen, like, A.J. Preller went to the Padres. You guys remember, One of the first things he did was to make a trade that involved dealing Max Fried and Trey Turner. These are guys that he'd never really been around, but he was, you know, hell-bent on trying to win right away, so he made a bunch of trades with players that he'd never seen before. And guess what? It kind of bit him in the butt, and it bit the Padres organization in the butt. With the Braves, Alex went in there and basically said, I'm just going to sit and wait, and I'm going to watch these guys, and I'm going to bet on the talent, and I'm going to wait for that to emerge. They did it with Max Fried, who in 2019, I think the year was, it was actually an internal debate. You know, should this guy be called up to the major leagues in September? Because there was a feeling that, you know, that the kid isn't very tough. He hasn't earned it. And I think Alex's perspective was very much like, you know what, we're going to promote him. We're going to continue to wait for this talent to manifest. My goodness, he's one of the best left-handers in baseball. That's exactly what's happened with Kyle Wright. Like, he was a first-round draft pick. No one ever doubted his talent. But, you know, unlike the Alec Manoahs, and Michael Harris of the world, there was an emotional transition for him. He got hit around in the big leagues, despite that great arm. And they sent him back down. He got a full year in AAA. I remember talking to Brian Snitker about him last year. And he said, you know what? We tend to promote these guys and expect that they're going to have success right away. That's not the way it goes for everybody. And so they waited on Kyle Wright. He had that World Series outing when the Braves reached for him out of desperation, and that seemed to give him the injection of confidence that he needs. And now all of that talent is fully manifesting at the big league level. So, you know, for me, a takeaway from what the Braves have done, not only with Kyle Wright but also with Max Fried, is you have to have some patience. You can't expect that everybody is going to develop at the same rate.
Buster Olney from ESPN is our guest. All right, Buster, here's something wild that happened in baseball that's never happened before. The Houston Astros had two different pitchers throw an immaculate inning, which, of course, is 9 pitches and 3 strikeouts. And the almost hilarious thing about it is both pitchers threw an immaculate inning to the same 3 hitters.
Yeah, and then that was yesterday, and it got me to thinking, because I saw this on social media. I wanted to ask you guys about this. Is this, how big of a deal is this for you? Is this like a just kind of a cool little thing that happened in a game, or is it actually kind of a big deal? Because the reaction on social media was huge, and I kind of fall along the lines of shrug of the shoulders. You know, I have a great colleague, Boog Shamba. You guys hear him, if you play the show, or if your kids play the show, like my son does. He's the voice of that. He does Cubs games. He did ESPN games for years. And whenever anybody hits for the cycle, Boog has got the shrug of the shoulders like, yeah, it's an unusual sequence. Who really cares? Like, I'd rather have a guy hit 4 homers, and that'd be a big deal, than go single, double, triple homer. That's the way I felt about, like, looking at all the headlines off the immaculate inning, where it's like, okay, so if they struck out the side with 10 pitches, it's really worth that much less. I kind of didn't care that much. But you know what? I'm old and I'm cranky, and I was wondering how you guys felt about it.
Yeah, you know, I don't think it's, like, I don't care, really. I don't think it's that big of a deal. I just thought it was... funny that it happened to the same 3 hitters in the same game. Like, what? That's never happened in baseball. You know, to have 2 different pitchers from the same team throw an immaculate inning in the same game, much less to the same 3 hitters. But not, yeah, I'm with you. It's more just like a bizarre oddity in baseball. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, it's a curiosity as opposed to being like some great feat. Because some of the stuff that I saw last night was like, wow, this is amazing. I'm like, yeah, I don't know. I think there are a lot of pitchers in the big leagues who can, you know, under the right circumstance, against the right team, could probably generate an immaculate inning.
I put in the category of a triple play almost. You know, like, it's incredibly...
It says nothing, right?
Yeah, like...
It doesn't say anything big picture.
It's just like, it's incredibly rare, but it's not as significant as throwing, like, a no-hitter. You know, like, the accomplishment of throwing a no-hitter to me is much more impressive than having one inning where it's just kind of like it's like a statistical anomaly, like the triple play. It's like, well, the circumstances, and like I think you're right, like hitting for the cycle. I will say that
hitting player stealing home.
Yeah, so, you know, like hitting for the cycle is a little more exciting to me from the standpoint.
Oh, yeah,
I know that if it's like a player that I or like a team, if it's your if somebody on your team, it plays out through the course of the game. So maybe that makes it a bigger makes it feel like a bigger deal. But all those things, they're just like they're just more like, wow, that's a cool thing, and then move on, as opposed to a guy that throws a no hitter. You know, you're like, man, that's an accomplishment that like,
yeah,
you know, you'll think about for the rest of your life.
Yeah, and the other part of this too is that we just see this, you know, generation of relief pitchers. They all throw 150 miles an hour. They come into the game, and there's so many strikeouts now. The idea that you're going to have three consecutive strikeouts doesn't feel like that big of a deal anymore. like, yeah, okay, you know. And so I don't know. It's often like at the end of the year when we look at the strikeout rates for pitchers, and someone goes, "Wow, he strikes out, you know, 10 per nine innings." You're like, "Yeah, okay." Along with 800 other people who strike out 10 guys per nine innings, it's not that big of a deal anymore to see strikeouts. When I was a kid, if you saw a hitter get 100 strikeouts, that was a really high number. Now, if you don't get 100 strikeouts, you're something special.
We have Buster Olney on the line. Buster, the AL Central is odd. You have the Chicago White Sox, one game under 500, and their fans are booing Tony La Russa, which I'm here for. And now they've lost their closer Liam Hendricks to a forearm strain. We've seen some other high profile managers lose their jobs already this season, in Joe Maddon and Joe Girardi. The fact that the White Sox are under 500 and the fans seem they've had it with Tony La Russa. Is Tony La Russa in trouble at all with the Chicago White Sox, you think?
Yeah, and we actually had a long conversation about that yesterday on a conference call, because this Sunday we've got the White Sox against the Astros. And I, you know, with every organization, these decisions come down to context. And the White Sox context is that Jerry Reinsdorf, their owner, is the most loyal person in baseball. Like, he, and to a fault, I think, throughout his career. For example, years ago, they traded outfielder Harold Baines. I think it was to the Texas Rangers. And Jerry really liked Harold. He was a great guy. And so the White Sox retired Harold's number as an active player, okay, because he felt bad about that. There have been a number of other examples of employees that he's kept, staffers that he kept, far longer than other teams would have under similar circumstances. And so last week when, fans were booing, you know, fire Tony, my instinct was, yeah, no chance. Like, you know, Jerry Reinsdorf has said that the biggest mistake in his time as the owner of the White Sox, which is, you know, more than four decades at this point, is firing Tony La Russa, or allowing Hawk Harrelson, in his 1 year as general manager, to fire Tony. And he brought him back, against the advice of a lot of people, and installed him in that job going into 2021. They won the division, and this year, unquestionably, part of the reason why they struggled was because of a lot of injuries. And so the idea that Jerry Reinsdorf is going to turn Tony La Russa into a scapegoat in midseason, I just don't see it. And maybe I'm wrong, but I'd say this, is that while fans have a perspective, you know, folks in social media have a perspective, even the front office members, the White Sox, they may have a perspective about whether or not to get rid of Tony. None of it matters. The only thing that matters is what Jerry Reinsdorf thinks, and I don't think he's going to fire him.
What if he keeps intentionally walking hitters with two strikes?
That one, I will tell you, he got a lot of criticism for that, and, you know, everyone sort of mocked him on social media. If you actually look at the underlying numbers, it's not as crazy as it seems. Like, Trey Turner has been unusually good the last 3 years, hitting with two strikes. And the guy that they intentionally walked him to get to, Max Muncy, had just come off the injured list. He's been stinking up the joint this year, especially against left-handed pitching. It wasn't the decision I would have made, or Steven, maybe not the decision you would have made, or Nate, the decision you would have made. But it wasn't as crazy as it was made out to seem, I think, by some of what was written and said. I got to tell you that.
I feel like maybe the baseball gods, like, no, we're not letting you get away with that one. Tony.
Oh, and by the way, I say this too. I thought Tony was way too defensive about it. You know what?
Yeah.
You're going to get asked about it. Don't say, have you seen the numbers? Just say, okay, here's what my thinking was. Here are the statistics, and this is what we did.
Hey, he's super angry at all times, and again, I enjoy it. So we'll see.
Oh, I've been on the other end of that, by the way. Okay. The one thing I've learned about Tony in my years covering baseball is Tony, you know, is a competitor. He wakes up every day, and I think he needs to get, you know, the juices flowing. By being angry at somebody, and a couple times he's ripped me by name, and at first he took it personal. I'm like, nah, it's not personal. That's just Tony going through his days.
He's just getting his juices flowing. You help him, Buster. That's a compliment to you. So in the NL West, the Dodgers, they have their hands full with the Padres. The Giants are right in it, and now the Dodgers have lost Walker Buehler. And I know they say he's going to come back by the end of the season, but what do you think?
I think there's a lot of reason to be skeptical about that. You know, and he mentioned, you know, the decision that he decided to have. And this is someone who, you guys remember, the Dodgers drafted him in the first round despite the fact that he just had Tommy John surgery. They bet long-term on his talent, and that certainly paid off. But he's already had one Tommy John. He had a bone spur on his elbow. And he acknowledged, you know, after he was taken off the other day, that, yeah, there's some risk here. Like, there's no guarantee that he's actually going to be able to come back from this forearm, you know, tightness that he has. I think given how long it's going to take, he probably is not going to be a big factor. And that's going to be one of the big questions, I think, leading up the trade deadline. What did the Dodgers do? Because they typically are one of the most aggressive teams, you know, trading for Yu Darvish, trading for Manny Machado last year. You know, Max Scherzer and Trey Turner. There's a clear need there for a starting pitcher, I think. But it's not a great starting pitcher market. So it'll be interesting. And they're going to have to compete against the Mets and some other teams for anybody who's actually out there. But, you know, we'll see how aggressive the Dodgers are going to be.
Call me crazy, but I think they could use a veteran bat off the bench like Carlos Santana. That's just me. I haven't really watched much Dodgers baseball, but that's the way I see it.
Speaking of Vinny Pasquantino, right?
Yeah, well, you know, just, you know, make create some room. Okay, so there was I had Nate send you a couple of topics, and if you don't have too much info, they're kind of wild cards, but we've talked so much about Andrew Benintendi being a trade chip for the Royals. Man, Michael Taylor all of a sudden leads a team in on-base percentage. His walk rate is up, strikeout rate is down. We all know how good he is defensively as a center fielder. He's under contract for this year and next year, a reasonable deal that pays him $4.5 million each year. Could there be a market if he continues to hit pretty well? Could there be a market for a guy like that for a team that may need an upgrade defensively at center field and a guy that's not just a runner player?
100%, and it actually, you know, we've talked about, you know, young players' trajectory before. I remember having a conversation with Dayton Moore about Lorenzo Cain and how for Lorenzo Cain, who didn't play a lot of organized baseball when he was a teenager and then he got started late, you know, what Dayton said is, and I remember Doug Melvin, who was the former general manager of the Brewers, felt the same way about Lorenzo, is that, like, you need to give these guys time. Michael Taylor is one of those players. Like, he was in the big leagues at a young age and on a really good team, and there was a lot of pressure on him. And, you know, he now, I think, in the middle of his career, seems to be figuring out it better as an offensive player. You know, a 361 on-base percentage, 272 average, and if you're a contending team, based on his experience, based on his defense, his ability to get on base, absolutely, that'd be someone that you'd look at. Now, we've talked about in the past how in the middle of the season, the market for position players is so specialized. You know, all the contenders will be looking for pitching, you know, reliever, starting pitcher. But The number of teams looking for, needing to have a specific need in the outfield or among position players, that's a much smaller list, and it's going to be up to JJ to, identify those teams and at least have the conversations about, okay, if we're willing to trade this guy, what would you give us for him?
Buster Olney, thank you so much for the time. We appreciate it. We look forward to talking to you next week.
Okay, guys.
Thanks. Buster Olney, always with great information. Buster Olney from ESPN. And now we know that Tony La Russa gets angry because he gets his juices flowing. So that's something he needs, right? At this stage.
Well, maybe we ought to introduce him to Willie Gay, the juice man.
Right, that's exactly right. We will take a break. When we come back, why don't we check in with our old friend Jared Sutton? I bet he'd be a good guy to preview tonight's Game 6 of the NBA Finals. Right here on Sports Radio 810 WHB. Welcome back to the Border Patrol on Sports Radio 810 WHB. We have our NBA insider, Jared Sutton, scout for the New Orleans Pelicans. And if he has one, it will I will deem it appropriate for intern Namdi to ask a question of Jared Sutton about tonight's game, if he so chooses. But he's not required. Or he can ask a question about the Pelicans. Let's invite Jared Sutton onto the show. Jared, hello. How are you?
Good morning, Stephen. Good morning, guys. How are we doing?
You're a very busy man. You've got meetings. You've got deadlines and commitments. You're like Bob Seger. What's going on with you as you you're knee deep in preparation for the draft, aren't you?
Yeah, I mean, I'm all in. This is the biggest week in terms of preparation. We're spending a lot of time putting our board together. We also have draft workouts still going every day. We have our own players in for workouts. This is such a blast of a week, though. It's exhausting. There's no question. But just the opportunity to, be around our front office guys, David Griffin, Trajan Langdon, Bryson Graham, who runs our scouting department. But then this is the most time in summer league. I will get time with our coaches as well. But around this time, our coaches are around to be able to sit down with Willie Green and Jaren Collins and Casey Hill and Fred Vinson. Fred, who's the best shooting instructor in the NBA by far, just to talk ball, talk players, and really fine-tune and iron out guys that we really like. We have three picks in this draft at 8, 41, and 52. So we're in a really good spot. Obviously, we're coming off a playoff berth, and we're the only team in the top 10 coming off a playoff appearance with a top 10 pick. So it's a great thing. The goal is to not be in the lottery next year, where we're making some headwind and we're in the playoffs and we're making a run in the Western Conference with getting Z back and getting Z healthy. And he's been in New Orleans working out. All of our guys are just attacking the offseason. And we got a lot of young guys, so that's a great thing to see. So it's sort of we're getting prepared for the draft, and that's the most important thing. And the meetings are going really well, and you're cutting up film and you're talking about scenarios. But I just think the time around our group, and that's everybody, that's our performance staff, that's everything with our psychologists and that part of the equation, ownership's around a little bit. It's just everybody together around this time. And across the yard is the Saints minicamp. So our owner owns both the Saints and the Pelicans. So just to see fans everywhere, too, when you enter the facility, it's just a lot of fun. The heat is no joke. That's the only thing I would say is you learn a lot about New Orleans around this time of the year with the heat, just walking to the meal hall, get lunch, those type of things. But busy week, but a great week, no question.
As I saw, you were over at Saints minicamp. Is it true that that Tyrann Mathieu is blaming Dan Sorensen for the heat down in New Orleans?
Yes, that's a good question. I heard rumors. I heard rumblings of it, but they are excited about Tyrann Mathieu just because of the LSU ties and all those things. But it was what's so fascinating about our setup here. It's so different, with other NFL teams and obviously NBA teams is you know, you go to lunch and, you know, all the Saints guys are in there and Alvin Kamara is eating lunch, you know, right next to you, like at the other table, you know, and it's just, it's so unique. But it's what makes New Orleans special. It's what makes working for this organization and Gail Benson so special too. It's just, it's different, but it's a blast. And it's a lot of fun.
Sometimes I have good sources. Sometimes I have terrible sources. And you tell me if this is accurate. I had a source tell me that to every draft meeting, you wear a Ochai Agbaji T-shirt from Charlie Hustle. Is that true? Yeah. Is that, because I think that's not subtle. That's not very subtle, Jared Sutton.
Yep. You know, every player, everybody, you know, chimes in. But with Ochai Agbaji, nobody else. It's just my world.
Right.
I talk about Ochai the whole time, right? I don't let anybody get a word in when it's Ochai Agbaji.
You stand up and say, by the way, he did attend Oak Park High School, in case anyone was wondering.
Right.
So, right. I usually
lead with that and close with that.
Right.
You know, that's my goal.
It's good info for the people making the decisions, Nate. So.
That's right. That's right.
Why don't you just go ahead and draft him?
Right. Can you? Hey. Could you? Could you just step in
just
and make the pick
in
ahead of everyone else? Do you have that ability? Do you have that autonomy?
That's right. I think we talked about this 2 weeks ago. Like, hey, there's a report out that, you know, we were taking him 8.
What?
So I mean, people are on it, right? So we
I'm on it.
I was really excited about tomorrow because we're supposed to have him come in for a workout on Friday, and he's already shut down. So, you know, I think he's done enough. He doesn't really need to be working out right now.
Oh, he shut it down. No workout, huh?
Yeah, that doesn't mean, you know, he's got a promise or anything like that. I just think he's pretty comfortable with where he's at. The agent's a big part of this with every player, of where their player's targeted. And a lot of these guys are, you know, Kenny Lofton Jr. from Louisiana Tech, who kept his name in. You know, there was a lot of conversation that he might go back to school. But he said he'll end up having 18 draft workouts when it's all said and done. And by the end of it, I was talking to him yesterday at our workout, and you can tell he's worn out. Like, he's got, this is it. This is the last one. These guys have been, you know, working out for teams, and it's been nonstop since they ended their college basketball season, put their name in, declared, working out with their agents, going to the NBA Combine, getting tested, interviews, pro days, all these different things and different events. Some of these guys play at Portsmouth, which is a, you know, senior-only event where you're looking at some of those four-year guys. Some of these guys now are three-year guys that they allow in there, but, you know, they have even more of a body of work that they've done since the season ended. So it's a full sprint to the draft, and right now you kind of see the light at the end of the tunnel. We're officially a week away, right? This, you know, this is Thursday. Next Thursday,
right.
It's on. So a lot of these guys, they're putting everything they can into this, and they're picked apart left and right, right? I mean, it's not just what they're doing on the floor, it's off the floor as well. And yeah, I think guys are just, they're ready, and it's time. So this is a good draft. I'm really excited about this draft, especially, you know, some of these names that kept their name in that we anticipated going back in an NIL world. But a lot of these guys are comfortable with two-way contracts, which I think is going to be a big part of this draft when you get into the second round. And you're talking about, you know, the two-way contract now, they've gone up pretty significantly. So, you know, we're talking $462,000 is a league minimum on a two-way. A lot of guys are thinking about that, and that's why they put their name in and stayed in. A lot of guys, I think, will continue to think about NIL. I think after, you know, as we continue to grow in the NIL world, of what that looks like for them to stay in college basketball, because some of these guys probably should have, but it is what it is, and now it's on us to really dive into these guys and make right decisions.
Did you punch a hole in the wall when you found out Ochai canceled his workout?
I was bummed.
Right.
I'll be honest.
Right.
I was bummed. I was trying to get, you know, two Oak Park kids in our facility wearing Pelicans gear. That would have been pretty nice, because just to have as a memory, right?
Just take your glass of water and throw it up against the wall. Okay, so
he did the Jerry West thing. He took a statue in his office and chucked it through a window.
I'm out of here. Okay, let's get into Game 6 of the Finals. You can listen to the game right here tonight on Sports Radio 810 WHB. Our intern Namdi, very bold, said before the series the Warriors will win in 6. This morning before the show, he said the Warriors will close this out and win in 6. Do you agree with Namdi, or do you think the Celtics will extend this series to seven?
I'm going to say they extend it to seven.
Wow.
I'm going to give Boston some love here. The history would say that in the playoffs, the Celtics are a very tough out, and they have walked the tightrope many of times in the playoffs. They've won multiple game sevens to get to the finals. They're 3-0 in elimination games, so I'm just going to go off of that alone. The reality is, though, if Boston turns the ball over like they did in game five, this series is over. They cannot afford to turn the ball over 18 times. So, to me, it's pretty simple. It's simple things that come down to, you know, giving if Boston has a chance to win. Boston has been in a lot of these games, in game three and game four in particular, and even game five, where the third quarter, we always talk about the Warriors and how they can just jump on you in the third. But in the fourth quarter, Boston has been there. They can't close. And that goes off championship experience. This is why I got Golden State winning this series. I do think when Boston plays like they're capable of and they get efficient play from Jason Tatum, when you get better shot selection from Jaylen Brown, when decision-making from Marcus Smart is better, when Al Horford shows up and is a factor, you know, all these things play a part in Boston when they win games. Now, the reality is, that dude, Andrew Wiggins, has been huge in this series. And he didn't shoot it well from three, right? I mean, he had 26 and 13, was 0 for 6 from three, and they also had Steph Curry go 0 for 9, and Golden State wins that game. So Nami's not wrong. I mean, I could see Golden State winning this game. I'm just going to go off the fact I think Boston has that type of DNA mentality of they'll fight back and get this. I want this to go to a Game 7 probably. This is part of it a little bit. But ultimately, I think Golden State's winning the series at the end of the day.
We're going to have Nnamdi hop in with a question here in a moment. Mm-hmm. I feel like all the other things aside, to me, it all comes down to turnovers for the Celtics. They can't turn it over 17
turnovers.
Times. Turnovers. They can't turn it over 17 times. If they take care of the ball, they have a chance to win. If they don't, they don't have a chance to win. I mean, why can't they be more consistent with that?
Yeah, it's been a problem. I think it, you know, when you look at the turnovers too, it's, you know, where's the bulk of them coming from? Is it in their front court? Is it in their back court? Is it off the bench? Is it your rotation? Whatever it is, most of the time when you look at their turnovers when they have bad games, it starts with Marcus Smart and Jaylen Brown. And Jaylen Brown has had, it's good Jaylen Brown and bad Jaylen Brown. Like, at one point, Jaylen Brown was in the finals MVP conversation with how he was playing. The reality is, again, what history shows us in the playoffs with Jaylen Brown, he'll have games where he's a walking turnover. And he's dribbling, you know, he's trying to force, he's trying to attack, he can't get by a guy, he's shaky with the handle. And especially in the NBA, if you're shaky with it, Golden State's defense is really good in terms of health side and shrinking gaps, where guys like Jaylen Brown can't turn a corner, can't get their lane and angle to the rim. Jason Tatum had four turnovers the other day. Tatum's had problems with turnovers. Typically, Tatum takes care of the ball. You know, he doesn't have these type of lulls. Now, he was very good in game five. That was the best Jason Tatum we've seen in this series. They need a consistent performance from him in that regard. But, look, turnovers, to me, it's a personal thing with some of these guys. We always talk about getting off the ball, and if the best thing when you're turning the ball over is making quicker decision and getting the ball out of your hand is the biggest, especially with Golden State's defense in terms of guys that really can lock you down. Draymond is going to be one of those guys. I think Clay, when he, you know, Clay's been up and down a little bit, but Clay can really get after you. And Wiggs and Gary Payton are these guys too that can really sit down, guard, defend you, and defend you in space. And if you expose the ball, they're really instinctual with their hands. So for Boston, it's get the ball out of your hand. You know, stop trying to go one-on-one isolated. It's not where you are as a team when you're good. Isolation ball, unless it's coming from Tatum in single coverage. And I said this a couple weeks ago when we were going into the finals, and even after a couple of those first games, like Tatum's decision-making when he puts the ball on the floor had to be faster. Timing is everything, and everything is so quick in the NBA. We talk about getting your shot off so quickly. Like, you cannot have any hesitation shooting the ball in the NBA. If you hesitate, it's a wrap. You're not going to be able to get your shot off. The same thing is with the handle. Like, if you put the ball on the floor, you better make sure you're able to see the floor and see the defense and see the read and the coverage, because the coverage has changed with every ball screen. When the ball's in different guys' hands, the coverages can be different. And Golden State switches their defense a lot. And the personnel they've gone in terms of changing different rotations, Steve Kerr has kept that pretty fluid. He's changed that here and there game to game. Boston's got to adapt a little bit better on the floor. And that's, I don't think it's necessarily a coaching thing either. I think it's some of these players understanding the game and the flow and the rhythm. And you cannot have back-to-back turnovers, most importantly. When you have this many turnovers, they compound. You got to take care of the ball. And everybody has to have that mentality of, we got to get a great shot. And if we miss the shot, fine. But we cannot turn the ball over. And you cannot turn the ball over in a live ball turnover situation against the Golden State Warriors. You cannot allow them to go play transition game. That just can't happen. That's a big part of this series, too. Boston is a very good transition team themselves. We saw that in game one. They got to be able to be better in transition. And also, Boston in their own building is going to be better, too. So that's another thing, I think, going for Boston. They'll be playing with a little bit more confidence. That's why I give them a little bit of edge to get out of this game six, to get it to a game seven. And then from there, man, we'll see what happens from there, because Boston's been in game sevens, but I still, again, like Golden State in this series.
We'll give intern Namdi the final word here. Do you have a question for our NBA insider, Jared Sutton? Please step up to the microphone. Here comes intern Namdi, who is a fellow Northlander, Jared Sutton. So please listen very carefully.
Hey, right. Jared, how you doing?
Good, buddy. How are you?
I'm pretty good. I'm very excited for this NBA draft. I think it's one of the best ones to come in recent years. And I had a question. It seems like consensus guys earlier on, like John Montero and Jaden Hardy, they've slipped in the mock drafts. So when you guys are drafting, do you believe that like the leagues that they play in, such as Overtime Elite or G League Ignite, helps or hurts like the players' draft stock? Like, are they getting the proper level of exposure that will properly prepare them for the NBA, or is it a matter of individual workouts?
That's a great question.
Wow.
So obviously with Ignite and with Overtime Elite, it's different paths now for guys to go to the league. And some of these guys have decisions that they have made where, you know, the money part of this plays a factor in why they're going the Ignite route and why they're going Overtime Elite, which was new. The tough part about Overtime Elite is they did not compete against anybody other than themselves. Gene Montero has professional basketball experience overseas, so that, I think, is a positive. The problem is, you know, he goes to Overtime Elite, and it's a total evaluation, different evaluation tool. You're still evaluating a player just like you would any player. But the pre-draft is very much more important in terms of seeing some of these guys in a different situation, which at our combine, which is different than the NFL combine. At our combine, guys have the opportunity to compete 5-on-5. Some guys back out of that. I think there's certain guys that should take that challenge and compete in 5-on-5 against a lot of these guys that are competing in the draft who have not had the opportunity to play against top competition, who like a Gene Montero, like you're referencing, for example. Ignite is a tough one for me because this year's Ignite team with Hardy, with Dyson Daniels, with Marjon Beauchamp, you know, with Foster, those guys are totally different than the crop of players that was Jonathan Kuminga's group last year, right? Those guys were at a different level, and it was the first year of Ignite, and the way Ignite played was in a bubble format. They weren't traveling. So I think that was a little bit of a benefit to them, but that had a team that had Jarrett Jack, who was an NBA veteran, who was an experienced NBA player. Those guys got to grow around NBA guys and the NBA coaches that were around them. It was just a different experience for those Ignite guys. I think that's why they succeeded and they were top draft picks, and you've seen the success of a guy like Jonathan Kuminga, where those guys, I think, had a little bit of an upper hand in what they were looking at. Jalen Green went second overall, right, from G League Ignite. Those guys were really good. Those guys were also coached, and that team was much different than this Ignite team that was very young. Dyson Daniels is going to be probably the top Ignite player taken in this draft. He's a 6'7 Australian kid who grew and improved throughout the year. But that team had different challenges than this Ignite team. So the scenarios, the situations are different. You still evaluate the player openly. You try to see these guys as much as possible. Their pre-draft is still very important. There's guys that played in college that had great college seasons this year who have struggled in their pre-draft process. They've struggled in workouts. They've struggled with athletic testing. Some of these guys maybe struggled in the interviews. So it's a full body of work that you put your the scout hat on, if you will, and you scout throughout the season, and you get to this point this week, and then it starts becoming decision time when you're putting your board together. And then ultimately you'll bring in your pro staff, and then you start working through scenarios. And then you're so prepared for the draft that you just let the board dictate what happens, and you have your body of work on every single player.
That was my nickname. Excellent in college, a full body of work. A lot of people call me
that's
that.
Right. That's right.
That was a great question. That was sadly for Nate and I the best question of the segment asked by intern Nandi, yeah. But that's fine. Yeah. Hey, Jarrett, thank you for the time. I know you say that it will be the Boston Celtics extending the series, and that'll be good for us because then we have game 7
yeah, let's go.
On the show. Thank you, Jarrett. We appreciate your time.
Thanks, guys. Have a good weekend.
That's right. That's Jarrett Sutton. Listen to game 6 tonight right here on Sports Radio 810 WHB. Welcome back to the Border Patrol on Sports Radio 810 WHB. Let's check the weather with Jeff Penner. That kind of rhymed. Hello, Jeff.
Hello, good morning. How are you guys?
I'm doing very well. How about you?
I'm doing good. We had some thunderstorms last night, and not everybody got the rain. There are some locations that are getting pretty dry. And so if you want to keep your yard green, it takes an inch to an inch and a half of rain per week this time of year for that to happen, especially every day we are in the 90s and it's been windy. And so we have one more chance of some thunderstorms tonight, but it's mostly going to be across northern Missouri and into central Illinois. We may get something late tonight, early tomorrow morning to slip in here. And if we don't get any rain tonight, it's going to be another 3 to 5 days before it rains. And today, it's going to be like 95 degrees, 96. It's going to be awfully hot today. And the difference today from the past days, not much wind. In the last few days, the wind helped a little bit. And not going to be much wind today. Chances of some thunderstorms later tonight and tomorrow morning. Tomorrow and Saturday be around 90, which is still hot. And then Sunday and Monday and into Tuesday could be well into the 90s. So that could be our first technical heat wave. Yes, it's hot. It might as well be a heat wave. But 95 three straight days is technically a heat wave, even though, who's counting? I mean, it's been 97, 93, and 91, so hot enough. And today is going to probably feel like the hottest day of the whole stretch because not much wind and high humidity. Anybody have any questions or specific forecasts? They would love to hear.
I will give you some homework. For tomorrow, I'll need a forecast for Lee Summit because Richie St. John will be performing with the Accidental Moguls at Bricks and Lee Summit. So if you could prepare that for me tomorrow, I would greatly appreciate it.
I will look at that very, very closely. And other than that, enjoy the day. The weekend is almost here. Here is Dr. Troy Burns with Pro Partners.
You know, most people are frustrated that they can never reach their doctor when they really need them. That never happens at Pro Partners. If you need easy, direct access to a doctor who knows you and is always available, give Pro Partners a call or check us out on the web at propartnershealthcare.com.
We'll be right back after this on Sports Radio 810 WHB.